A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it hits surprisingly close to home. I've spent the last few weeks rebuilding a broken home server from scratch, learning one motherboard layout, sourcing obscure components, and it nearly broke me. And every time I visit a car garage, I watch mechanics handle an almost infinite variation of vehicles every day, and somehow know what they're doing, and I can't stop thinking about it. The core question is deceptively simple. How long does it take to qualify as a car mechanic, and how does shops manage to pull off this seemingly impossible feat day after day, both in terms of what's in their heads and what's on their shelves?
This is one of those questions where the answer reveals an entire hidden world of systems design. And the server rebuild is the perfect entry point, because you experience the exact pain that mechanics have solved institutionally. You had one machine, one motherboard revision, one set of components, and it still took weeks. An independent shop sees 50 unique vehicles a week, sometimes more. They're not smarter than you. They've just built systems, both mental and physical, that make the impossible look routine.
I kept thinking. I had to learn the pinout for one power supply unit, and it took me 3 hours of forum diving. These people are pulling wiring diagrams in 30 seconds and moving on to the next bay.
That's the first misconception to bust right there. The average person assumes mechanics have memorized every car ever made. They haven't. What they've learned is a language, a systems-level understanding of how engines, transmissions, brakes, and electrical architectures work, and then they use reference materials for the specifics. It's the difference between memorizing every sentence ever written in French versus actually learning French.
Let's break this down properly. How long does it actually take to become a mechanic who can handle anything that rolls into the bay? And what does that training actually look like?
The baseline in the United States is ASE certification, the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence. To even qualify for the test, you need 2 years of on-the-job experience, or a combination of a 2-year associate degree plus 1 year of experience. And that's just to sit for one exam. There are over 50 ASE certification tests covering everything from engine repair to collision damage. A master technician has to pass all 8 core series exams and recertify every 5 years because the technology keeps moving.
The 2-year mark isn't the finish line, it's the starting gate.
After 2 years, you're what the Dreyfus model of skill acquisition would call an advanced beginner. You can do basic brake jobs, oil changes, maybe a water pump. You're following procedures, but you don't yet have the pattern recognition to diagnose a tricky intermittent electrical fault. That takes 5 to 10 years. Most mechanics hit competent or proficient somewhere in that range. True expertise, the level where you can hear a noise from across the shop and know exactly what's wrong, that's 10,000 hours territory.
That's the thing I noticed watching my server rebuild. The first time I had to trace a short, I was just guessing. By the fourth time, I'd developed a mental flowchart. I imagine mechanics are doing that across dozens of systems simultaneously.
They are, and the cognitive science here is genuinely fascinating. The human brain can't hold a complete schematic of every vehicle in working memory. What it can do is chunk information into reusable patterns. A mechanic doesn't see a 2024 Ford F-150 and think, okay, let me recall all 14,000 things about this specific truck. They see, this is a twin-turbo V6 with a 10-speed automatic, port and direct injection, independent rear suspension. Those are modules they already understand. The specifics, torque specs, wiring pinouts, fluid capacities, those come from the service information system.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. You mentioned the 10-speed automatic. I did some reading, and that transmission was co-developed by Ford and General Motors. It's in the F-150, but it's also in the 2025 Mazda CX-90, the Chevy Camaro, a bunch of different vehicles across brands. A mechanic who's rebuilt that transmission once can infer a huge amount the second time, even if it's in a completely different car.
That's a perfect example of platform sharing, and it's one of the hidden forces that makes the job tractable. The automotive industry has consolidated around a relatively small number of architectures. The same Bosch ABS module shows up in a dozen European cars. The same Denso alternator is in multiple Japanese brands. Mechanics learn these common building blocks, and then the brand-specific stuff is a thinner layer on top.
That still leaves the diagnostic challenge. I had a check engine light equivalent on my server. A drive failure that could have been the drive itself, the cable, the SATA controller, or the power supply. I spent hours isolating variables. Mechanics are doing this with far more complex systems, and a customer waiting in the lobby.
They're doing it with a structured methodology that I think is underappreciated. Let me walk through a real diagnostic tree. A 2018 Honda Civic comes in with a check engine light. The mechanic plugs in a scan tool and pulls code P0420, catalyst efficiency below threshold. The amateur move is to replace the catalytic converter and hope for the best. That's a $1,200 part, by the way. The professional move is to recognize that PO420 can be caused by an exhaust leak, a failing oxygen sensor, a fuel trim problem, or an actual failed catalyst. So, they check the oxygen sensor waveforms with an oscilloscope. They smoke test the exhaust for leaks. They look at short-term and long-term fuel trims. Only after eliminating everything else do they condemn the converter.
They're doing this with a laptop and a subscription to something like Aldata or Mitchell 1, which gives them the factory diagnostic procedure, the wiring diagram, and the known good values for every sensor.
These are the mechanics equivalent of what you were doing on forums, except it's structured, verified, and searchable in seconds. Aldata and Mitchell 1 are massive databases that aggregate factory service manuals, technical service bulletins, and repair procedures. A shop pays a monthly subscription, and the mechanic has instant access to essentially the manufacturer's entire knowledge base. Toyota has TIS, Ford has PTS, and the aftermarket tools unify all of it.
The thing that struck me when I was researching this is that OBDDSEC, the standardized diagnostic port that makes all this possible, is only 30 years old. It became mandatory in all U.S. cars in 1996. Before that, every manufacturer had their own proprietary connector, their own codes, their own diagnostic protocol.
Before OBD2, mechanics really did have to memorize a lot more. The standardization of the diagnostic interface was a quiet revolution. It's one of those infrastructure improvements that nobody thinks about until they realize what life was like before it. The first OBD standard was California in 1988, but the federal mandate in 96 is what changed everything. Suddenly, one scan tool could talk to any car, and the data stream was standardized enough that pattern recognition across brands became possible.
The cognitive side is a combination of systems-level training, pattern recognition built over years, and instant access to reference materials. That's how one person can handle 50 different vehicles a week. But there's a second pillar here that I think is just as impressive, and it's the one that really resonated with my server rebuild experience. The physical inventory. How does shops store and retrieve parts without losing their minds?
This is where the logistics get elegant. And it's a problem you felt viscerally. You had to order one SATA cable, got the wrong connector angle, had to reorder, and the server sat dead for another 3 days. A shop can't have a car stuck on a lift for 3 days because someone ordered the wrong alternator.
I was stocking for one machine. A shop is effectively stocking for every car that might roll in, which is an unbounded set. How do you even begin?
You begin by accepting that you can't stock everything. The average independent shop carries between 500 and 2,000 SKUs in-house. That sounds like a lot, but there are over 50,000 distinct parts they might potentially need. The trick is a three-tier system that I think is directly applicable to anyone organizing a workshop, a server room, or even a home inventory.
Walk me through it.
Tier 1 is fast-moving consumables. Oil filters, brake pads, spark plugs, wiper blades, common fluids. These are stored in bins right near the service bays, often with a bin tag system that has a reorder point printed right on the card. When the bin gets low, the tag gets pulled and the part gets reordered. It's dead simple, it's visual, and it doesn't require a computer.
The stuff you need every day is within arm's reach. That makes sense. What's tier 2?
Tier 2 is medium turnover parts. Alternators, starters, water pumps, brake calipers, radiators. These are in a central stock room, organized either by vehicle make or by part category depending on the shop's philosophy. Some shops group all Honda parts together, others group all alternators together regardless of brand. There's no one right answer, it depends on the shop's mix of work. A Honda specialist will organize by model. A generalist might organize by part type. Tier 3 is everything else. Engine blocks, transmission rebuild kits, specialty sensors, model-specific body parts. These are not stocked at all. They're sourced on demand from local suppliers, NAPA, AutoZone, O'Reilly, or dealer networks, often with multiple deliveries per day. A shop in a major metro area might get 4 or 5 parts deliveries daily. The car gets diagnosed in the morning, the parts are ordered by 10, they arrive by 2, and the car goes home by 5.
The physical inventory is actually a just-in-time supply chain, disguised as a stockroom. The shelves are a buffer, not the whole solution.
And this is where the shop management software becomes critical. When a service rider creates a repair order in something like Shopware or Mitchell One Manager, the system automatically generates a pick list. Parts are pulled from inventory before the car even enters the bay. If something isn't in stock, the system integrates with supplier catalogs and can place the order automatically. Barcode scanning verifies that the right part was pulled. It's warehouse logistics applied to auto repair.
This is starting to sound less like a greasy garage and more like an Amazon fulfillment center.
In high-volume shops, it essentially is. Some shops use Kanban systems with 2-bin replenishment. When the first bin of brake pads is empty, the second bin is pulled forward and the empty bin triggers a reorder. It's the same system Toyota invented for factory production lines, and it works beautifully for parts inventory.
Here's the part I kept tripping over during the server rebuild. Even when you have the right system, parts change. A manufacturer will revise a component mid-production run, and suddenly there are 3 different versions of what looks like the same part. How do mechanics deal with that?
This is called parts supersession, and it is one of the hardest problems in automotive repair. A 2005 Toyota Camry might have had 3 different alternator part numbers over its production run due to running changes. The connector style changed, or the amperage rating was updated, or the mounting bracket was revised. If you order by year, make, and model alone, you have roughly a 10 to 15% chance of getting the wrong part.
That's a nightmare, and it's exactly what happened to me with the SATA cable. Same cable, different angle, totally useless.
The solution is the VIN, the vehicle identification number. Modern parts catalogs require a VIN lookup, which narrows the part to the exact production date and factory configuration. Some shops will even check the production date on the driver's door jam sticker to be absolutely certain. The parts illustration diagrams in the catalog show exploded views of every component, so the mechanic can visually verify that the connector orientation and mounting points match before ordering.
The VIN is the mechanic's checksum. It's a hash that resolves the exact configuration.
And it's a system that evolved over decades of painful experience. Every independent shop has a story about the time they ordered a part 3 times and got it wrong, 3 times because of an undocumented mid-year change. The institutional knowledge gets built into the process.
Let me pull on another thread here. You mentioned that even with all these systems, 5 to 10% of parts orders still have errors. What happens when the wrong part shows up?
The car waits. It's a cost of doing business. The mechanic diagnoses the mismatch, the shop calls the supplier, and a correct part is sourced, often through a will call pickup where someone physically drives to the supplier's warehouse. The car might stay on the lift an extra hour or overnight depending on the complexity. Good shops build this into their scheduling. They don't promise same-day turnaround on jobs that require uncommon parts.
This is where the relationship with suppliers becomes critical. I've noticed that the best mechanics have a guy at NAPA they can call who actually knows what they're talking about.
The human relationship layer on top of the digital catalog is still essential. A good parts specialist at a supplier knows the supersession history for common parts, knows which aftermarket brands have quality issues, and can suggest alternatives when a part is backordered. That expertise is invisible to the customer, but it's what keeps the shop running.
To summarize the physical side, shops use a 3-tier inventory system with just-in-time delivery for slow movers, barcode verified pick lists, VIN-locked parts catalogs, and long-term relationships with suppliers. And the whole thing operates with about 90% first-time accuracy.
That accuracy number is actually remarkable when you consider the complexity. The shop is effectively managing a catalog of 50,000 parts for hundreds of different machines, any of which might roll in on any given day. Compare that to your home server, where you had one machine and still got the wrong cable.
In my defense, the connector angle was not clearly documented.
It never is. That's why the parts illustration diagram exists. Mechanics learned that lesson the hard way decades ago, and the entire industry built systems around it.
Let's pull this together. We've got two parallel systems here, the cognitive load and the physical inventory, and they're both built on the same principle. Don't memorize, systematize. Learn the principles, use tools for the specifics, and build processes that catch errors before they become disasters.
That's the insight that I think applies far beyond auto repair. Whether you're organizing a server room, a home workshop, or a garage full of holiday decorations, the same principles scale. Let's make this concrete. What would it look like to apply the 3-tier system to a home inventory?
Tier 1 is the stuff you reach for constantly. Batteries, light bulbs, USB cables, tape, scissors. That should be in a drawer or bin that you can access without moving anything else. Tier 2 is the stuff you use a few times a year. Spare power supplies, specialty tools, replacement filters, labeled bins on a shelf, organized by category. Tier 3 is the stuff you almost never need but can't throw away. That goes in deep storage, and you accept that retrieving it will take effort.
The digital inventory system is the other half. You don't need shop management software for your home, but a simple spreadsheet with a column for location, quantity, and reorder point will do the same job. There are even free tools like Part Keeper designed for electronics hobbyists that do barcode tracking and inventory management.
The spreadsheet is your external memory. Just like the mechanic isn't trying to remember every torque spec, you shouldn't be trying to remember which box in the attic contains the spare router. Write it down. Search it later.
The systems thinking piece is the deepest lesson. When you understand the principles, you don't need to memorize every variation. You are rebuilding a server. Once you understood that power supplies have standard pinouts, that SATA connectors come in straight and right angle variants, that motherboards have specific form factors, you could reason about the problem instead of just following a parts list. That's exactly what a mechanic does with engines and transmissions.
The Dreyfus model you mentioned earlier maps onto this perfectly. A novice follows a checklist. A competent practitioner recognizes patterns and adapts. An expert intuits the solution before they can fully explain it. I was at the novice level with my server, and I could feel how much cognitive effort that required.
Most mechanics are operating at the competent or proficient level after 5 to 10 years. They're not at the expert level for every system, but they're good enough to diagnose the common problems, and they know when to consult the manual for the uncommon ones. The humility to look something up is actually a marker of competence, not weakness.
That's a good segue to something I wanted to ask. How much of this job is shifting towards software? Cars are becoming more software-defined. Electric vehicles have fewer moving parts, but vastly more complex battery management and thermal systems. Is the mechanic of the future going to be more of an electrical engineer?
This is the open question hanging over the entire industry. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects about 67,000 job openings for automotive technicians each year over the next decade, but the skill requirements are changing fast. An EV has no oil changes, no spark plugs, no timing belts. But it has an 800-volt battery pack that can kill you if you don't follow the safety procedures, and a thermal management system that's more like a data center's liquid cooling than a traditional radiator.
The parts inventory shifts too. Fewer alternators, more inverter modules, fewer exhaust systems, more battery cells, and a lot of fixes that used to require a physical part are now software patches pushed over the air.
Which is a fascinating inventory problem in its own right. When a part is a software update, the physical supply chain disappears entirely. But when a physical part does fail on an EV, it's often a high-voltage component that the corner shop can't stock because it's too expensive and too model-specific. The 3-tier system still applies, but the mix of parts shifts dramatically.
I wonder if we'll see the same platform consolidation in EVs that we saw in combustion engines. If every EV uses cells from the same few battery manufacturers and motors from the same few suppliers, the mechanics systems thinking approach still works.
I think it will. The Hyundai eGMP platform underpins multiple vehicles across Hyundai, Kia, and Genesis. Volkswagen's MEB platform is in everything from the ID.4 to the Audi Q4. The building blocks are consolidating just like they did with combustion platforms. A mechanic who learns one EV architecture can transfer a lot of that knowledge.
The core insight holds. Learn the systems, use the tools, don't try to memorize everything. Whether it's a 1998 Camry or a 2026 electric SUV, the methodology is the same even if the technology changes.
The inventory management principles are even more durable. The three-tier system, just-in-time delivery, digital catalogs with VIN-level precision, those will work regardless of what's under the hood. The parts might change from alternators to inverters, but the logistics of storing and retrieving them don't.
What can someone actually do with this? If you're listening and you've got a garage full of tools, or a server rack, or just a closet that's become a black hole of random cables and adapters, what's the takeaway?
First, adopt the three-tier system today. Figure out what you use every week and put it within arm's reach. Figure out what you use every few months and put it in labeled bins on a shelf. Everything else goes in deep storage or gets donated. Don't try to stock everything. You're not an auto parts warehouse and you don't need to be.
Second, use a digital inventory. Even a Google Sheet is infinitely better than your memory. Columns for item name, location, quantity, and a notes field for whatever weird compatibility thing you'll forget in 6 months. The Mechanics LLL Data subscription is their external brain. Your spreadsheet is yours.
Third, learn systems thinking in your domain. Stop memorizing part numbers and start understanding categories. You don't need to know every USB cable variant ever made. You need to know that UESB, A, UESB-C, micro, UESB, and mini, USB exist, and that they have different data speeds and power delivery capabilities. The specifics you can look up. The framework is what stays in your head.
The next time you visit a mechanic, ask them how they organize their parts. I've done this, and it's one of the most interesting conversations you can have with a tradesperson. They're proud of their systems, and they should be. It's a hidden world of logistics that most customers never think about.
If you're the kind of person who's ever spent a Saturday afternoon building a parts bin labeling system, you'll recognize a kindred spirit. The mechanic who color codes the brake pad bins by manufacturer is your people.
Before we wrap up, let's look ahead. As cars become more like computers on wheels, how will the mechanic's job change? Are we going to see a split between software diagnosticians and hardware specialists, the way IT split into developers and systems administrators?
I think that split is already happening. Dealerships have dedicated diagnostic specialists who do nothing but troubleshoot complex electrical and software issues. The independent shops are slower to specialize, but they're investing in scan tools that can do module programming and ADOS calibration, not just code reading. The mechanic who refuses to learn software is going to be the mechanic who can't fix anything built after 2020.
The parts inventory question gets weirder when you think about it. If a car's problem is fixed by an over-the-air update, there's no part to stock, no bay to occupy, no oil to recycle. The entire physical footprint of the repair shrinks to zero. But the diagnostic skill required goes up, because now you're debugging a distributed system with dozens of electronic control units talking over CAN bus.
The CAN bus is a great example. It's a network protocol that lets the engine computer talk to the transmission computer talk to the ABS module. Diagnosing a CAN bus fault is more like network engineering than traditional mechanics. You're looking for voltage drops, termination resistance, signal integrity. An oscilloscope becomes more important than a wrench.
Which brings us back to your server rebuild. You are debugging a machine that's essentially all CAN bus equivalent. The skills are converging. A good server technician and a good automotive diagnostician are doing increasingly similar work, just with different form factors.
Both of them are system integrators, not just part swappers. That's the through line of this entire episode. The mechanic who looks like a magician is really just someone who's built excellent systems, both mental and physical, for managing complexity. The next time you're frustrated organizing your own stuff, remember the mechanic who sees 50 different cars a week and somehow finds the right part every time. It's not magic. It's system design.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1940s, katabatic wind speeds in Greenland were recorded exceeding 200 miles per hour, making the island's ice sheet one of the windiest inhabited landmasses on Earth at the time.
200 miles an hour. That's not wind. That's a planetary exhalation.
I'll remember that next time I complain about a stiff breeze.
Here's the open question I'm left with. As the physical parts of cars become simpler and the software layers become more complex, will the mechanic shop of 2040 look more like a data center than a garage? And will the parts inventory of the future be a server rack running diagnostic virtual machines instead of shelves of brake pads? I don't know the answer, but I suspect the systems thinking we've been talking about will be the bridge that gets us there.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your favorite podcast app. It helps other people find the show, and we read every single one. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by the indefatigable Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Go organize something.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.